Thank you very much, and it's my great pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the conference organizers for giving me the honor of being able to speak here today. This is my first time in Madrid, and I haven't seen very much of it so far, but I'm looking forward to the opportunity to see the city. Those fish are from Cadiz. I want to talk today on the topic Beyond the Classroom, From Virtual to Reality. And I want to begin with a story about a trip that I took once. This is a number of years ago. I took a trip on a boat called the Tribal Warrior. This boat was moored in Brisbane in Australia. It was just on the river there, and I was just walking around the city. And I saw the boat, so I walked onto the boat, and what they told me is that the tribal warrior was traveling around in Australia from city to city promoting awareness of the Aboriginal community in that country. But more, the tribal warrior was being used to train Aboriginal youth in Australia, training them to attain their master's level certificate their maritime certificates so that they could pilot their own boat to make their own livings. And it seems to me that this is what online learning was all about in a nutshell. You know, we think of online learning, we think of computers, we think of the internet, keyboards and screens. But to me, the promise of online learning has always been that it will allow us to take our learning outside the classroom and into the community. Now, when we think about it, you know, we think about learning using the internet as virtual reality. But when we ask ourselves, what is virtual, what is real, and we reflect on it, we realize that what is happening in the classroom is what is virtual, and what is happening out in the community is what is real. I want to suggest to all of you today, something that I've suggested over a number of years, is that online learning gives us the opportunity to move learning from the virtual, from the text base, from the abstract and the simulated that we present in the classroom, and to take it out into the community, and thereby making learning, for the first time, I think in a very long time, making learning real, making learning authentic, making learning community-based. You think about the ways of representing knowledge that we have, the ways of representing learning that we have, and we can think of a range from one side to the other of different possibilities. On the one hand, we have text. And text, the printed word, is probably the least real of all the forms of knowledge that we have. It is the most abstract. And then we have stories and simulation, and finally, to our own personal experiences, the things that we do and the things that we see and we sense in the community. And that is the most real, the most concrete. That is where reality is actually happening. The written word, although we take it as a paradigm for learning, as a paradigm for knowledge, is an abstraction. It is at once, twice, maybe three times removed from whatever it represents. It is necessarily vague. It is necessarily something that requires a translation, a codification, an interpretation. And so it's subject to ambiguity, it's subject to multiple interpretation, it's subject to misunderstanding. Text is virtual. It is the most virtual of our realities. It is more virtual than the virtual reality we have even on the computer screen. And text necessarily cannot represent the full range of our experience. Michael Polanyi, talking about knowledge in his book Personal Knowledge, describes most of our knowledge as tacit knowledge, ineffable, inexpressible in words. So what we try to do, all of us who are teachers, all of us who are parents, who want to promote learning, is we attempt to make learning more real. We attempt to make learning more than just the printed word on the page. And one thing we do is we begin by storytelling, by making learning come alive. I used to work at a center called the Arusha Center in Calgary, and my position there was in development education. And the position was, they called it an animateur, which is a French word, but it means animator, a person who makes alive, a person who makes more vivid or more colorful. There are many forms of storytelling, many ways we represent our reality. On the left you see an Aboriginal painting that I saw on a cave wall in Kakadu, a park in Australia. And there they are expressing not just their ability to draw fish, although they can certainly do that, but also they are teaching themselves and their children about how to cut open a fish, what parts of the fish to eat, what parts of the fish to throw away. We have forms of storytelling. The dragon in Barcelona that I saw at the train station, again, is a way of talking about our culture, talking about our history, talking about our values. We have many ways of storytelling, not just the word. We have music and we have theater, and these are not simply abstract arts that we do for pleasure, but rather our attempt here is to create a wider range of experience, stimulating more senses, touching ourselves more emotionally, more really. But it's even better, as we all know, as learners we all know, when we participate, when we interact, when we ourselves become part of the story, when we ourselves become part of the culture and part of the learning that we are trying to impart onto our children and onto our students. Now, there's been a lot of talk, a lot of discussion about online learning, and most of this discussion about online learning stops here, right? It stops with the text. It stops with the facts that we are trying to get people to learn. If it's good online learning, it might even include some dialogue, some conversation. But if it seems virtual when it's online, it's because in that form, the learning is indeed virtual. But what makes it virtual is not the computer system. What makes it virtual is what we are doing with the computer system. We are using the computer to tell rather than to do, rather than to experience. My own work online is a bit different. My own work online, as an instructor, as a teacher, as a philosopher, is about involvement, about creation, about community, and about participation. The online world, Web 2.0 as it's sometimes called, is for me a place to put my pictures, and that's something that involves me in the community as I go out and I walk around cities and towns or bicycle out in the country and I take my pictures. But not just that, I put my pictures online and I share my pictures and I share stories with my friends. The online world is a place for me to store my videos. And again, my videos, it's not simply the act of creating a video, but it's the act of being in the community and engaging and interacting that makes creating videos something that is valuable to me. It's a place for me to connect with other people. For example, to write an essay with my colleague in Montreal on, what else, the nature of online learning. It is a way for me to stay up to date, right up to date, up to the minute, with my friends, many friends who are scattered around the world. And it's an amazing thing when we think about it that someone could have friends around the world. It's a way for me to save money on phone calls. And you might think, well, that's not very significant, but when I travel like this, I'm here in Spain and my wife is in Moncton in New Brunswick in Canada, it would cost me a fortune to talk to my wife. But I talk to her, I not only talk to her, I use video conference, which is something that was not even available before the internet, really. And I do that every day, and I'm able to stay in touch, and it's almost like I'm home, even when I'm on the road. It's knowing where I'm going to be staying before I even get there, through facilities such as Google Earth. And again, something like Google Earth is a wonderful tool, but what makes it a wonderful tool isn't the technology, isn't the picture on the screen, but rather the fact that what is shown in Google Earth is reflected in the community. That I can look at the map in Google Earth and know that these are the buildings and these are the streets that I'm going to experience when I get there. It's an easy way for me to draw pictures. And believe me, I need an easy way to draw pictures. And again, not just to draw pictures, but to draw them collaboratively with my friends and to share these pictures with other friends over the internet. And so, just as the internet and Web 2.0 has changed my life and has touched my life in many ways. Web 2.0 and e-learning 2.0 are going to touch our students, our learners, in many ways as well. If we think about it and think for a moment as educators about the different views, the different ways of seeing learning resources that we have. Usually, when we think of a learning resource, we think of it the way we think of knowledge. We think of learning as contained in books. We think of learning as a thing, as a type of object. Even in the world of e-learning, in the world of online learning, when they were deciding how we were going to create learning management systems and how we were going to structure our learning online, we called our learning resources learning objects. And the way of organizing our learning online would be to take these learning objects and to put them in a repository, like a library, thereby, again, treating these learning resources as though they were static, as they were concrete, as though they were objects. That's one way of thinking of learning resources. Another way of thinking of learning resources is to think of learning as an event, much like this event here. Usually with one person in the front, like this, and usually with an audience, a diffusion of knowledge, a class, a lecture, a seminar, a meeting. It's still something fairly static, still something fairly concrete, still something, interestingly, very rooted in the written word, in the text. These first two models, the model of learning as an object and the model of learning as an event, are what might be called information theoretic. That is, rooted in information, rooted in semantics, rooted in content. And they are medium-based. That is to say, they depend on the physical medium. They depend on the paper. They depend on the place. They stress content. They stress organization and structure. They stress linear thought, one thing after the next, one sentence after the next. They stress rules. All of these are abstract ways of thinking of learning. All of these are more virtual than the learning that the internet allows us to have. The third way of looking at knowledge and of information, and the way that our students are increasingly looking at knowledge and looking at information, is to think of learning resources as a flow. To think of learning as though it's a river. To think of knowledge and information as a river. It's not something that you capture. It's not something that you hold and store on a shelf or put in a room, but rather it's something that you taste, that you dip your foot into every once in a while. Learning as a flow stresses the flow, the embeddedness of experience. Learning as a flow stresses the recognition of similar things, not the holding onto of the same thing. What does this look like, this idea of learning as a flow? What do our students see when the students look at the internet? Well, right off the bat, probably the most obvious thing, the most obvious instantiation of Web 2.0 is what has come to be called user-generated content. User-generated content is almost the exact opposite of what we will find in the library. The library is static, it's objective. User-generated content is personal, it's opinionated. But also, too, the content in the library is limited, it's scarce, it's expensive. User-generated content is like a tsunami, like a tidal wave of content. If we try to catch it all and hold it all, we will drown in the information. The best we can do is treat user-generated content as though it were a wave and as though we were a surfer. And we try not to memorize the form of the wave. We simply try to react to the wave, to adapt to the wave. The internet and knowledge and learning to our student today is not static content, it's not dates, it's not names, it's not faces. Rather, it's a network of interactions, a network of contacts. George Siemens talks a lot about this when he talks about the philosophy and the pedagogy of connectivism, the idea that no person stores everything that they need to know in their own brain. And there's a reason for that, and the reason is that there's much too much to know, and also that what there is to know is changing constantly, so there's no way that any person can hold everything that they need to know in their own brain. Rather, we participate in a learning community and in a knowing community through our interactions with our friends and our neighbors, and our knowledge comes, yes, partly from our own brain, but also from the network of interactions, from the network of contacts. Learning for the students today is immersive. It is not sitting passively in an audience, listening to somebody talk to them, like us older generation do. Learning is to actually be involved and embedded in some sort of activity. I have on the screen here a game that I spent way too many hours playing called Civilization. And it's interesting to play Civilization because playing Civilization teaches you about civilization at the same time. But the fact that it's immersive means that it teaches me many other things at the same time. It's a way of multitasking my learning. Being immersive means learning about history. It means learning about balancing resources in the economy. It means learning about planning ahead. It means learning about recognizing what the opposition in this case is going to do. All of these many skills are all at once involved in an immersive simulation instead of being presented one at a time in order like they are in a classroom. Learning today means new roles for students, not simply as passive receptors of learning, but as creators of learning. A lot of people talk about open learning resources and online learning resources, and they talk about how expensive they are to produce, and I say to them, well, you have the largest, cheapest workforce in the world right there in your students. And it is your students who should be producing these resources. Your students who should be producing these learning materials. Sure, some of them might not be good, but more importantly, some of them will. It's new roles for teachers, not as deliverers of knowledge, not as authorities or holders of knowledge, but rather as advocates for students, as coaches and mentors, helping students navigate their own way through the wide range of information. And for the rest of us, for those people in the community who are plumbers, who are carpenters, who are lawyers, who are judges, it's a new role for them as well, because we will learn more and more that in a fully connected world, everybody is in his or her own way a teacher. And that we will all have a role in our jobs to teach, to show, to model, and demonstrate, and involve the younger generation in what we are doing as part of their own learning. And you know, when you think about it, this is a way of learning that actually takes us back to our own culture and our own history, when it was the case that when we went to work, our children went with us. And when we did our job and talked to our friends and all of that, our children were there with us. And our children were part of our lives. And it's only in the industrial age that we thought it was a good idea to take our children and send them off to a little room all by themselves where they would be abstracted from all possible experience and call that learning. And we will find that we will no longer be doing this because we will be able to offer all of the advantages of the classroom while at the same time being able to provide for students in the community at large. It means learning as a network phenomenon. It means learning as embedding ourselves and our children in the community and involving all of us in the same set of interactions, in the same set of communications. Thomas Kuhn wrote in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, talking about how science and knowledge develops in a society. And what he said is that learning a science, learning a technology, is not learning all of the facts. It's not learning all of the theories, and these will all change over time anyways. Rather, he said, it's learning how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. And people sort of scratch their head about that, although we've all struggled with the problems at the end of the chapter, or at least I certainly did. But what he meant was learning to be a physicist, say, is learning how to think like a physicist, learning how to talk like a physicist, learning how to see the world in the way a physicist does. And you don't learn that by being told about physics. You learn that by being a physicist, by embedding yourself in a community of physicists and seeing how they talk, seeing how they model and demonstrate their own practice, and then reflect that practice yourself. It's a web of user-generated content, of entities like Wikipedia, where the people who read the content are also the people who write the content, and where there is no longer a separation between the authority of an Encyclopedia Britannica and the lesser people who are the readers, but rather the authority and the people become one and the same. It is social networks and communities, people creating their own groups, creating their own associations as needed, where needed, when needed, without barriers, without conditions. It's networks of interaction where students, instructors, teachers, everybody work with the widest range of contents, of photos and videos and text and multimedia and whatever. And they take these from a wide variety of sources. They bring in this content. They aggregate this content. They remix it. They reform it. They repurpose it. They shape it to their own needs. They adapt it to their own context. And then, most important, they don't hold on to content, they don't hold on to knowledge, but rather, fundamentally, they feed it forward. They share their knowledge as widely as possible, where this becomes the dominant value of our society and culture. Learning in such an environment becomes personal. Learning in such an environment becomes based not on the institution, but based on an individual and this person's connections with the rest of the world. An individual not separated from society, not an atom, not an atomistic type of individual, but an individual embedded in a fabric of society, drawing strength from the other people in the community and sharing strength in turn. We see this sort of learning being employed in things like immersive simulations. I was working with the Canadian Forces. The Canadian Forces do peacekeeping operations around the world. And they use games very much like the games students play with, you know, guns and bad guys and things like that. But the objective of their game, the military tell me, is not to go around shooting bad guys. The whole objective of their use of this game is to teach people how to work as a team, how to communicate with each other, how to obtain, as they said, the right result. And the right result, even in a combat situation, is a result where nobody is killed, nobody is injured. And that is the hardest military strategy of all to enforce. Learning is like what's happening in Detroit, where the students don't sit in the classroom and learn about wildflowers through books, but rather they go out and draw and photograph wildflowers for themselves on field trips, and then post these online. Learning is like the way some of these junior high students spend 11 months at sea on the coral reefs in the South Pacific, learning about the coral reefs by being on the coral reefs. And you think about how the internet makes this possible, because it used to be the case, if your children disappeared for 11 months, you would worry. But now, if your children disappear for 11 months, you know you're going to get a phone call from them every day, or an email message from them, and far, far too many photographs and videos. Learning today is like the Chaos Pilots Project in Denmark, where the students design and implement their own project, whether it be a service project or whether it be a commercial project. This is up to them. They decide what their project will be. They decide what their learning will be. The next step, where we go from here, is learning not just on the computers. It's learning not just in the devices we carry, but it's learning that is available, as they say, ambient learning. Learning that is, as they say, ubiquitous. Learning that is wherever we want it to be. People ask me, what does that look like? And I ask them to think about learning as though it were like water or as though it were like electricity. Again, it's something that flows, but it's also something that is available in the wall or in the ceiling, as the case may be. Think of learning of the future the way we have writing today. We have writing everywhere we need it. We have writing on the walls. We have writing on the floors. If you lift those panels, you'll find more writing. Learning in the future will be like that as well. I'm reminded of a book by an author called Bruce Sterling. The book is called Distraction. And a group of people in this book decide to build a hotel. And so the hotel is shipped to them as a pile of parts, you know, wood and doors and sinks and things like that. And they need to put this hotel together. And the pile of parts begins to instruct them on how to build the hotel. The hotel teaches you how to build a hotel. An example I've used many times is something called the smart fishing rod. And what happens here is you buy a fishing rod, you go out to the wharf or the pier, and you decide to go fishing. And you cast your line into the water, and your fishing rod remarks to you. It says, you've never fished before, have you? And I sort of look at the fishing rod, say, no, I haven't fished before. How did you know? The fishing rod says, well, I can sense these things. And the fishing rod proceeds to teach me how to fish. And it may teach me directly, and it may teach me through my PDA or through my computer or whatever, but the fishing rod shows me how to fish. The learning is right where I need the learning to be. And this applies to more than just skills. This applies to more than just things like fishing rods or writing on the wall. Think about how you would teach civic politics. Would you teach the art of municipal politics, the art of running a city, by talking about it? Or would you instead create an environment where anybody could enter into that environment and not just learn about how to govern a community, but take part in the governance of a community? And so now we ask, with all of these things coming, with all of these changes coming, with the internet becoming a powerful dominant force, with the very idea of facts being overturned, with the very idea of knowledge being overturned, how do we shape learning? What is it that we ought to do now if teaching people facts, teaching people mathematics, whatever, is no longer going to be enough? What do we need to teach our children today? Well, here are some things to teach children today. First of all, how to predict consequences. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know what the situation is like in Spain, but in North America, people are not really taught very well how to predict consequences. They're not taught how to predict the future, and so we have a lot of wishful thinking that happens in our country as people do things without actually thinking about what will result. There are many ways new technology allows us to predict consequences, allows us to learn how to predict consequences, but to do so safely, we can do so in a physical way using technology like the Wii. We can learn how to predict increasingly complex consequences in a game such as SimCity. And we can learn how to predict consequences when dealing with fundamentally unknowns, such as other people, through interactive games like World of Warcraft. We need to teach our students how to read. And by how to read, I don't mean just pronouncing the words, and I don't mean just a basic superficial level of understanding, but how to read in a deep way, how to read such that the reader can understand what is being inferred, what is being argued, what is the evidence for that basis. And we see that learning to read isn't simply memorization of form, it isn't simply grammar and vocabulary, but it's a way of thinking about reading that involves looking for signs, looking for clues in the text, looking at the many different ways an author will lead us forward through to a conclusion. And these are skills that allow us to read not only text, but to read, well, the multiplicity of signs, but also to read images, to read video, to read multimedia, and indeed, like the Aborigines of Australia, to read nature, to read the animals, and the weather itself. We need to teach people how to distinguish truth from fiction. And again, this is a problem that is evident in North America. And the very first thing we need is to grant ourselves and grant our students the capacity to actually question what we are told. This is a fundamental value. And question what we read, and question what we see on television and on the internet, with the deluge of content, with a million different authors, this becomes fundamental to being able to make any sense at all out of the world. But on the internet, we have ways of being able to check for the reliability of information. We are able to form networks with our friends. We are able to exchange our knowledge, exchange our beliefs. And if we structure the network in the appropriate way, if we include diverse sources, if we allow and encourage autonomy of these sources, if we keep connected with these sources, and if we keep our networks open, barring nobody, then our ways of being connected give us the capacity to be able to judge for ourselves what is true and what is false. We need to learn and we need to teach our children how to empathize, how to see beyond just ourselves, how to imagine how something even as simple as a line of text on a computer screen can be another person, how that line of text can have thoughts and feelings and lives and children and parents and pets and hopes and dreams. We need to teach ourselves and our children the capacity to be the other person, in our own mind at least. And we see that the creation of a technology like the World Wide Web and the capacity for sharing that weblogs and wikis and message boards and SMS and instant messaging and all of that give us is the capacity to see in a more rich and detailed way than ever before what different lives are like, what different cultures are like. And they allow us to more, in a more detailed way than ever before, place ourselves into the shoes of other people, into the lives of other people. But again, it's this sharing that brings this about. Without this sharing, there is no capacity, no development of empathy. We need to teach ourselves and our children how to be creative, how to invent new things, to come up with new ideas, to create new culture, to create new art. And the internet today and computer technologies in general have given us unprecedented tools for creativity. Now art no longer is the sole purview of the artist. We can all be artists. We can all combine. We can all express ourselves. We can all make our meaning instantiated in the world. We need to learn how to communicate clearly, how to form our own thoughts in our mind, and how to express those thoughts as clearly and as coherently as possible. And the internet gives us the capacity to learn how to do this. The capacity not only to be able to create these thoughts, to create these communications, but more importantly, fundamentally importantly, the capacity to have an audience for these thoughts, to communicate our communications to other people and to see for ourselves how they react, whether or not they understand, whether or not they agree. We need ourselves to learn and to have our children learn how to learn. How to learn, that is to say, how to create the conditions in our own lives that the patterns of connectivity in our brain that constitute learning are created. How to shape our own experience, to shape our own practice, so that it becomes more than just memory, but it becomes a way of life and a way of being. And the internet makes this possible. Computer technologies make this possible by letting us take control, by letting us actually do things, by letting us practice. It's our media, our content, our patterns, our learning that we create for ourselves. We are the node in the network that creates and passes along information. We need to learn how to stay healthy, how to keep ourselves healthy in an increasingly unhealthy world. And the internet, even here, helps us out, helps us not depend on external authorities like doctors and medical books and dentists, but rather we learn about our own health and our own well-being by ourselves and from each other in our community. We compare notes with each other. We exercise together, even though we may be in very distant locations. We need to learn how to value ourselves. We need to learn ourselves and to teach our children to say that we are valuable, we are important, we matter, what we say and what we do matters. And this is the sort of thing that we do each and every day when we get online and when we create a photograph or a video or a bit of text or whatever. We are saying to the world, what I have to say matters. And we are saying this to ourselves over and over every day. And that teaches us that we are valuable. We are valuable because we instantiate that value. And finally, we need to learn, and we need to teach our children to learn, how to live meaningfully. I'm tired her right out. We need to learn and teach our children to learn that what we are doing, whatever it happens to be, is the most important thing that we are doing at any given time, and most importantly, that it is our choice and our decision to be living the life that we are living now. And the fundamental aspect of this is choice. It is the capacity to make decisions. We've always had the capacity to make decisions, but new technologies, internet technologies, computational technologies are like an extension of our capacities, and most importantly, an extension of our capacity to make decisions. We learn by using these technologies is that the world, not just the virtual world, but the real world, the world that we live in, is quite literally what we make of it. And that is probably the most important lesson that computational technologies can teach us, and that is probably the most important lesson that we can use the internet to teach our children. which brings us back to the tribal warrior, which is about teaching people not how to pilot a boat, not how to do mathematics or any of these other things, but it's about teaching the Aboriginals who are on this boat about meaning and value and what's important and how to live. The internet frees us from the constraints of the artificial, from the constraints of the virtual, and brings us forward into reality. And with that, I thank you for your time and your attention.
You're in teaching that you use all technology.
My own software is your first home. So that when I need it, it's all.
Pero aquí me gustaría darte un poco de en nombre de lo que te lograron, que te lo presentaron a mí. Gracias.